You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with myself, Owen Walker. In this episode, we're going to be speaking on the approach to major incidents with Keir Rutherford and Alec Wilding. So what we wanted to do in the episode is just look at some of the lessons learned from anecdotal practice and indeed management of major incidents on scene, and also look at some of the reflections from previous recommendations from major incident inquiries such as the Manchester bombings. We also wanted to look at how the evolution of terrorist attacks has evolved over time, so the differentiation of what otherwise might be a routine run-of-the-mill call, which would be maybe a road traffic collision, and how we can differentiate that from a more serious terrorist attack on scene. I also wanted to look at the initial approach to triage, how that should be done, so the integration of some of these recent tools such as 10-second triage algorithm and the major incident triage tool, and also look at the level of enhanced care at scene. So how should that be performed? What should the ceilings of care be on scene? And indeed, how should the interplay of the casualty clearing station work on scene? So we also wanted to look at this concept of team of teams and interdisciplinary working. So working with other responders such as the police, fire brigade, and indeed other emergency services. So to do this, I have Keir Rutherford and Alec Wilding with me. Keir is an advanced paramedic practitioner in critical care. He's also a flight paramedic with London's Air Ambulance. Alec is also an advanced paramedic practitioner in critical care, and he's also the EPRR, so the Emergency Planning, Resilience and Response Lead for Festival Medical Services. So these are a charity providing medical events, or indeed medical cover, for complex and large events such as Glastonbury. He's also a specialist paramedic for Hampshire and the Isle of Wight Air Ambulance. So just before we kick off with the episode, I just wanted to let you know this is going to be part of two episodes, as there was far too much really to go at within one episode. So this episode is about 60 minutes long, and we're going to release another one next week with the other end of this conversation. I really do hope you enjoy. Welcome both to the podcast.
Hi, Owen. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thanks, Owen. Morning.
So just I wanted to start by just getting your reflections on practice within major incidents. So maybe if you could both speak to your reflections and indeed experience within major incidents. And maybe, Keir, if I could get you to go first and then Alec.
Yeah, I think my experience is I've been in the ambulance service for 19 years this year now. I think I moved to the LAS from an external trust in 2015. So I think really all my experiences around these types of incidents have predominantly been in London. And I think coming from another service, and I've grown up in London, but I found that working in London and certainly in a kind of critical care role, both as an APP, but also then later on with LAA, it's a very unique place to work. With a very unique high kind of tempo of patients and critically sick and injured patients. And London's got a long-standing history of major incidents, which has been able to kind of build itself up from its experiences to learn from. And as such, it's the LAS, it's got a framework really to deal with these incidents, including, you know, kind of, it's got a large experienced EPRR department, got two heart teams, tactical response unit, a cadre of kind of incident response officers who work, you know, 24 hours, CTMs who respond on 9/7 call signs, kind of all the way through to the kind of control room and its own designated kind of control room for major or significant incidents. And for us within critical care, I suppose we've had a lot of the incidents only the APP, and I come from an APP on this because all my experiences have been around that, is that, you know, we're a relatively small team of up to 40 clinicians, and a lot of people have had experience of managing these types of incidents, and for both systems in LAA and APP is that we've had high exposure to kind of real world experiences that we've learned from, and that's kind of shaped the way that we practice. And clearly in kind of from November 2016 through to 2017, we saw a large number of major incidents and significant incidents, including the Croydon tram crash, London Bridge, Westminster Bridge, Grenfell. I suppose for me, my reflections, the incidents I was involved in, both from EOC and operationally, were London Bridge, Croydon, Fishmongers Hall, as well as some other significant incidents. I suppose my take-home points that I'll probably will talk a bit about later is that the importance of that first 20 minutes, your performance under extreme stress and fear as well, the importance of clinical leadership by senior clinicians, the importance of walking the scene, and also really about not all P1 patients are the same, and that some P1 patients are sicker than the others, and some are actively dying. I think I'll talk later about really perhaps that kind of approach to that patient group and how we identify them. And finally, we have to understand the disease process of the patients that we're seeing, and not just because it's a major incident change the way we care for them. And we should do really what we do day in, day out for them. Certainly in London, around penetrating trauma, we promote really on short on scene times to move into hospital. And we probably should have to try and remember that.
And Alec, yourself?
Yeah, I think similar to Keir, actually, I came from an ambulance service outside of London in 2012, joined London, and yeah, very different. I remember I went from a sort of a more rural ambulance service to obviously a very busy London urban area. And I remember, yeah, it certainly took a while, took like the first year to get used to the higher tempo of work, the higher volume of critically injured and ill people. And there's just more of everything, I think, in London. Was really fortunate to have been given really, really good, what I felt at the time was, you know, really thorough, really helpful, useful training in sort of major incidents, and just to give me an idea of what to expect, really. And then I think in 2015, 2016, maybe I was a team leader at Brixton and Oval, and completed the Bronze Commander course. So the majority of my sort of training in this sort of stuff started then, and completed the Bronze Commander course. And that really, really set me up. I felt really prepared for the next year when I found myself at Westminster Bridge quite early on as the incident was sort of unfolding. But again, sort of reflecting and looking back on it now, having done the course, you know, relatively recently before having found myself there, it really gave me the tools and you know, gave me an idea of what to expect. And even though you can never really, I think, really sort of fully expect to be in that situation or what you might have to, what you might need to do. I certainly, looking back on it now, you know, I'm really grateful for the training that I've had. And yeah, and similar, as Keir said, with sort of now doing the APP role and obviously having been to some other sorts of complex and challenging incidents. I think it's funny, we talk about major incidents and actually like it's just a term, it's just this defined term. And there's been a lot of significant incidents in London and, you know, around the country as well, that never get sort of, you know, they never quite tip that threshold into being a major incident, but can be really, really challenging. I think when we talk about this stuff, they kind of sometimes get overlooked. And I think what's good now is that, particularly in London, I think we're really good at ramping up early. And I know some of the stuff that seems to be more commonplace in practice now, things like people giving ethane reports to a, you know, like an RTC, relatively simple RTC would still give an ethane report, and getting used to that reporting mechanism. And just, you know, I think everyone's now understands the concept of it's easier to ramp up early and scale down than, you know, to be, I think perhaps when I started, maybe apprehensive about declaring a significant incident or a major incident. You know, it seems like quite a big thing, but actually it's just a term that will, you know, get you a then defined response. I think that's the really, really important thing when we're talking about major incidents. They don't, you know, I think they're often associated with you know, a really, really bad day at work. And it's not obviously to detract away from the fact that a lot of major incidents inherently by their nature, you know, involve sadly lots of people being horribly injured or becoming really unwell or even dying. But there's been other major incidents that the ambulance service has been part of that, you know, have been challenging, but not been the same. So there's the Stratford Olympic pool incident a little while ago where 200 people were evacuated and as a result of a chlorine gas leak, and lots of people had shortness of breath, and you know, that's challenging to respond to. It's challenging to manage, but at the same time, you know, these are good opportunities to put all this teamwork stuff into action. And yeah, I think we're very lucky in London. You know, we've got a lot of resources, there's a lot of training, and you know, a lot of people who we're lucky to have learned from their experiences, you know, who've walked down that path in the past and either made the mistakes or are here to talk about their experiences, so we can all sort of learn from them. So yeah, like yourself, Owen, obviously, you know, with your experiences, I think it's good to have these conversations. But yeah, that's my sort of personal reflections, I think, from the last 11 years in London.
So Keir, just looking at what Alex just said there about, you know, the lessons learned about ramping up early and escalation of resources, you know, in the contemporary climate, we in the not too distant past had the Manchester bombings report, and indeed there is more focus now on major incidents more than ever. Could you maybe speak to some of the changes to our approach, and indeed emerging themes which have come forth from some of these contemporary reports?
I think my kind of taking is around the initial kind of care. I think that's what you're asking, I think, Owen, on that, is that, and it's not just from Manchester, but probably through multiple incidents, including things like the Derek Bird shootings, it's about the access to patients in potentially in situations that might potentially have safety implications. And for me, I think one of the big reflections I took from my experience is around the need to actively, the importance of reducing preventable death and accessing a certain cohort of patients that we know are critically ill and need rapid access to them and intervention to keep them alive, followed on by evacuating them quickly and progressing them through the scene to definitive care. So with that comes in everything else and a structure in place that needs to be kind of followed. But I suppose, like, my takings really certainly looking at Manchester is absolutely that kind of delay to getting to some patients, and you know, really that kind of lack of situational awareness, or the kind of loss of situational awareness, and that only three clinicians ever found themselves treating patients in the city room, one APP and two heart paramedics. But it also showed the role of senior clinicians, and you know, an APP, I think he was in there for 40 minutes, I think, by himself. And I think Alec wants to talk more broadly about that later. And also, again, like many incidents, the importance of bystanders. But it also showed reoccurring themes around extrication and moving patients. And perhaps some kind of, that perhaps didn't go as well. And that, you know, the kind of how patients were moved. And I suppose for me as well, it's around the time that patients spent in the casualty clearing station. And there were some kind of discussions, I think, both in the Kerslake report and the recent Manchester inquiry report around patients being stabilised in the casualty clearing station. And I think it's all around probably about the importance of flow and about moving people through the scene as quickly as possible to hospital. And I think what, in the Kerslake report, he said that, you know, that having patients for a period of time in the casualty clearing station, it allowed the hospitals to prepare operating rooms. But at the same time, we know from patients with penetrating trauma that the longer they spend on scene, the chances are they may have a higher mortality. So it kind of, there's a conflict there between what published evidence really, and I think the important thing is the patient flow.
Alec, from your perspective.
So with regards to Manchester, I think the first thing that every time I read the report or I hear someone talking about the report, the first thing that always comes to my mind, really sort of, feel a lot of empathy for the responders who attended the Manchester bombing. And I think it's hard, even having been to, again, it's this term major incidents, and they're so varied. You look at the last 10 years and the things that happened, and you've got things, as Keir's already sort of alluded to, Grenfell and these terrorist attacks and all these other, and lots of really challenging, significant incidents as well. But Manchester is quite unique, and I think the reason that the Manchester bombing is quite unique in the UK, and even further afield actually, is that it was children that were deliberately targeted. And I think it's really hard to imagine turning up to something like that and there being so many young people with such serious horrendous injuries. And I think the reason it's significant is the moral injury from that is always going to be really high. It's not something we've seen in London where children have been deliberately targeted. I know, obviously, there was the Wimbledon incident a couple of weeks ago, which very much sounds like, I know it's also early days yet, but this is still different again. But I think, the real kind of injustice would be to, for all of us who work in the emergency services, the real injustice would be to not talk about this stuff and not learn the lessons and not look at this. So it's good. I think it's good to talk, it's really important that we talk about it. And as Keir said, from my experience, I think from listening to lots of people like Keir talk about his experiences at London Bridge and the other APPs and the HEMS teams that have been to these big incidents, the one thing that's really clear is that the first 20 minutes of any incident like this is critical, not just to dictate the flow, as Keir was talking about, but also when it comes to making those decisions to stop preventable death. And that's the one thing from Manchester that really came out, is that, this there's this concept of decision inertia, wanting to wait for more information that may not even come before being able to make a decision. And I think, again, from my experience talking to other people, there's that need for rapid decision making. And in an ideal world, it's commanders are going to be making that jointly and together. But it's also, I think, really important to accept that that's not always possible. And often, if you can see something that needs doing, and you're going to make that dynamic risk assessment yourself, then there's a job to do and we need to crack on. It's also unlikely that any other service is ever going to say that it's safe. I can't imagine a situation when the fire service, the police are going to turn up and be like, yeah, it's safe, you guys can go on in. It's just, I think these are they're sort of almost false narratives that we want to have to reassure ourselves. But the reality is, the buck's got to stop somewhere. And I think a lot of the time that's us, but it has to be dynamic. And that's not to say that people should go rushing into situations, but there's this, the concept of the what if trap. And at Manchester, there was this concern around a second device, but there was no credible evidence of it at all. So I think it leads to needing to rely on gut instincts, but also to mitigate the what ifs. And there's tools in place that commanders use, like Eric PD and this sort of stuff. But I guess speaking from experience, Kira and I both attended the Brixton Academy incident in December. And I turned up very early on. I was in control when the call came in, was dispatched to it quite early, as soon as it became clear it was something out of the ordinary. And lots of calls from the police saying lots of people were being crushed. And again, it was all very, as you know, from being in control. And I guess this is as well, this speaks to the importance of that early reporting on scene. Being in control and seeing these reports coming from the police of you know, 1,000 people being crushed, you kind of think, you know, there's something not quite right here, or it's hard to really imagine, you know, what is this all just, no disrespect to our colleagues from the police, but is this the police, perhaps, you know, something's happening and there's obviously some, it's stressful and they're making requests for ambulances, but actually, is it just a large crowd or, you know, is there something a bit more nefarious going on? So I dispatched myself to it without any real sort of, you know, kind of like, oh, wait and see when I got there. Parked a couple hundred metres up from the academy, and I could see lots of people coming, sort of heading towards the car. Crowd seemed at that point relatively calm, but as I moved closer, it was clear. And I think most people would have seen the videos now, they're all in the public forum. And, you know, it was quite a large, angry, volatile crowd. And it's one of those moments where you sort of, you kind of have your inner Ralph Wiggum moment where you sort of think on the back of the bus, like, I'm in danger. But actually, you sort of think, you know, let's be realistic about this. You know, there's lots of people that are volatile and angry and are throwing bottles, but they're not throwing them at me. No one's taking an interest in me. I'm just another person here. And what I do know is there's been reports of people being given CPR inside the foyer. And the foyer is right there, and there's a police officer with his baton out, and he's gesturing for me to come forward and help. They're there having bottles thrown at them, and you know, it's not a pleasant situation, but you know, we're all okay. Like, I can go in a little bit further and have a look, and if at any point you know, I feel like suddenly I'm at risk or I can always just turn around and go back. And you know, I went into the foyer, and then in the foyer there was we had what I've sort of referred to as a little protective bubble with a few police officers that were there administering care to sadly the people who've been injured in the crush. And you know, and I think, and I was very cognizant of what had happened at Manchester, because I could have just sat in the car, and sort of technically done things by the book and said, I don't feel safe, there's people throwing bottles, you know, I need to think about my safety and other people's safety. And you know, to a degree, you can't really, I mean, we've seen that in the Manchester report actually, that I think the consensus was that perhaps resources could have been deployed. It's this what if, this what if trap. But, you know, and I was very, very mindful of all the things that come out of the Manchester report and thought, actually, you know, it sort of, if there's people in there that need help, I can go and have a look. That's okay. You know, this is like Notting Hill or, you know, a big football riot or a protest. We've all been in those situations. Like, you know, there's nothing to suggest that anyone's got a direct issue with me. Yeah, that'd be a different job. So I think it's got to be balanced. It's got to be weighted. And a lot of people afterwards, I had a few people say, and it certainly wasn't, it never felt like a criticism, but there was a few healthy discussion at the London HEMS Clinical Governance Day. And Kia, you were there, to talk about that decision and, you know, was it safe? Was it dangerous? And, you know, I think sometimes, as I sort of alluded to, you know, you've got to make these rapid decisions, and it's like critical care. Sometimes you might get it wrong. And if you get it wrong, you know, there are opportunities for us to learn from and, you know, and hopefully get better. But I think the sort of almost the worst thing would be to enter into this decision inertia, not make a decision, and then actually find out that had I sat in the car and there were two people who'd, you know, asphyxiated in an aero complex PA that we could have maybe done something for, and that opportunity and that window of opportunity going. And so, yeah, I mean, that's sort of I don't know, Keir or Ryan, like, obviously,
yeah,
your experience from 770, and how does that relate to how you felt on the day? And, you know, because again, these are very, as we sort of talked about, these are very different incidents. You know, a lot of people being crushed in a volatile crowd is very different to, you know, multiple explosions going off. Did you even, when you first arrived at 77, were you aware of what else was going on in London? It must have been very much at the forefront of your mind, or was it not? I don't know.
Yeah, very interesting you said it, Alec. I think there is this almost analysis or paralysis by analysis, and indeed
like you said, sequential information coming at you. You never have the full picture. To Keir's point about how early intervention and early decision making is absolutely prudent. You can never quality assure there's never a secondary device. We absolutely, to your point, actually, Alec, about making decisions of risk benefit analysis just briefly as you go in to do some triage, and certainly in 7-7 in Orgate and in King's Cross, it was about this rapid triage and actually going into a carriage with another colleague to actually share the decision making. Priority one, priority two, yeah, priority one, let's go, and that sequential clearing. But actually the craving for knowledge, you almost you have to put that to bed, because you're just never going to get that full picture. You're only going to get a certain amount of situation awareness, and like you say, you have to move and make decisions based on that, and that presupposition in the future has to be exactly the same. We're never going to have the overall picture until the incident's done, and there's always that there's always that segmenting graph, isn't there? The longer you wait, the higher the physical and probably the moral injury, the pathology reveals itself more and more over time, but actually the mortality increases. So actually the earlier the intervention with a certain level of appreciation of risk, then it's beneficial. I don't know how that lands with yourself, Keir.
Yeah, I think with my experience, certainly the one I talk to most is about London Bridge, really, and around being dispatched as the initial kind of response to what was a single patient in traumatic cardiac arrest on the bridge. And then very quickly finding myself in what at the time was really an evolving, still an ongoing terrorist attack. And finding yourself in a very unique situation so early that you hadn't prepared for, because your mindset has very much been on one patient. And suddenly finding yourself in feeling considerable fear and threat for your safety and your life as well, I think, certainly in the first 20 minutes of that job, with ongoing shooting by the police and not really being aware of who was actually shooting at the time. But then I think it's, you know, as working in London and working as APPs, you become quite used to working in complex and challenging environments that can often be fast changing and often aren't necessarily always what you think they're going to be when you arrive. And I think kind of talking about safety, I can really remember, you know, we know a lot of incidents are over quite quickly. We know London Bridge was over within 8 minutes. I think Westminster was over very quickly. And when we look at a lot of incidents around the world, generally they have a short time where they're actually, there's an active threat. And we know, like Manchester, when they looked at it, and they actually, if you turned to zoning by 2250, it was actually a cold zone. And I think for me, you know, kind of reading the scene, engaging situational awareness, and I think I was probably I can look at London Bridge and I think I can kind of like reflecting on it afterwards, you're like subconsciously using people as an indicator for active threat. And I can remember being there and being told constantly by the police that, you know, there's an active shooter coming down from the South Bank. But actually, that was people calling in 999 calls saying they could hear shooting and could hear shooting, but they were hearing shooting in London Bridge. Or they were finding IEDs, or there's a hostage situation, or there was an IED in the van. And I think the fog of war, like you say, Owen, you're never going to truly, truly know what the genuine kind of risk to safety is, as opposed to what might be perceived, because the fog of war, that's going to happen. There's so much information. It's so chaotic. And it's interesting. I think like we probably look at a lot of those incidents around what happened in 2017 and we talk about safety, which is critical. And, you know, it's really important. We have a duty of care to our staff and we have a duty of care to patients. but how many members of staff were actually injured? And we talk about, you know, kind of threats from an active shooter or from a secondary device. But really, probably what do we think about is that potentially some of probably what the current evidence shows is that, you know, the real probable some of the safety risks where they lie are more conventional scene hazards. So things like contaminating dust, you know, kind of collapsing structures, secondary contamination at chemical incidents. And probably for me, the really big one is the impact of mental health on people post these incidents. And that's probably something that we don't talk about as often as we probably should be. But yeah, that's probably my experience and take on it.
So let's just pivot for a second and look at the initial, so even before the response, the EOC piece, the Emergency Operations Center. So the 999 call or 001 or 911 call to an initial incident. Could you both speak to, maybe Alec, if you could start to speak first about around just how important it is to set the wheels in motion and to get the sort of the right information and indeed the sort of right response from point of call.
Yeah, sure. So in London, I think on the critical care desk, typically the APP will sit next to the HEMS paramedic, and it's I think it's a really, really, really important relationship that sort of you have on the critical care desk, if you like, working together when things like this happen, and you've got that person to sort of bounce things off. And I think again, through experience working in London, through incidents that have happened in London, we're all kind of aware now of it's a high volume system. When there's a something that's going to be a job in inverted commas, like, you know, I refer to it being a job as in it's going to be one for the HEMS team, APPs, or it's going to be a bigger job that's going to require a certain response, there's certain tells, if you like, and normally it's things like multiple calls in a single area, all sort of saying relatively similar things. It might be I think at Westminster, for example, and London Bridge, I think they both initially came in as RTCs, you know, oh, there's a van has hit lots of pedestrians on the pavement, or again, they're both the same, they're both sort of vehicle-borne attacks. But I think it's having people, and again, talking to the critical care desk who are there listening in to certain calls, who can then pick up on those subtle bits of information that people are saying that would make something sound out of the ordinary, if you like. It's having those, I know people in the military talk about these sort of battle signs, if you like, that there's little tells that you sort of subconsciously pick up on. And it might be like, you know, someone's been hit by a van on the bridge and they've been thrown into the water. Like, that to me would suggest high speed, deliberate, you know, that sounds less like an accident, or multiple people that have been hit. Obviously then if, you know, something very more specific, there's been an explosion, or, you know, they've got out and they've got knives or something, then, you know, that's a pretty more sort of apparent. But I think now in EOC, we're quite fortunate in London, we've got use of all the CCTV cameras. So again, it's really, really helpful. Keir talks about the fog of war, you know, this big sort of wading through all of this information to try to, you know, to pinpoint exactly the bits that you need to know, you know, because even though we talked about earlier, it's good to ramp up early and set up and get all these things in process. And it's not just major incident, sending 20 ambulances and four officers, it's opening up a separate area of the control room so particular people can go in there to manage the incident separately, so that business as usual in London, the capital, is busy, can still continue. It's so that the scheduling teams can look at the rostering for people that are going to be coming in later that night. So the colleagues who work in the logistics department can think about moving ambulances, because they're going to be all over the place, you know, and there's people that need to come in for their shift at 6 o'clock. It's it's a big, big mechanism. And even though it's good to, it's important to declare early to ramp up, it's, as we sort of alluding to earlier, it's a technical term that will then trigger a response. And it's much more than just sending a few ambulances and the HEMS team and an APP. It's massive, but it's all there for a reason. So I think going back to call taking, and obviously some certain things can happen that we would declare a major incident from the control room. I'm trying to think of some examples, if there has been any recently where it's been, I guess something like, you know, it sounds horrible to even think of, but, you know, a large plane crashing near Heathrow. If you had reports and information of that coming in, you know, it would be safe to declare a major incident from the control room. And certainly there's been significant incidents that have been declared from the control room, you know, as information has come in, high-rise fires where multiple London Fire Brigade appliances are going. So, yeah, I think, and that's evolved over time, you know, that's been something that has evolved an awful lot, I think, in the last 10 years. But yeah, again, at the same time, I sit here and I say, I think this is something that we do well in London. And, you know, maybe that's not something that we say very often. And you know, maybe we should. We're very lucky in London. We sort of, you know, have a lot of people with a lot of experience, this sort of thing, and have a lot of experiential learning. But at the same time, there's absolutely no place to be complacent and sit here and say, oh, well, you know, aren't we great? Like, you know, this is a constant process of, you know, looking at what we do and is this the right thing, and learning from other people and looking at the Manchester report and thinking, you know, is this something that, how would we mitigate this stuff? How can we do better? And I know you're going to touch on some aspects around triage as well. You know, there's still some further change coming in over the next year, which I think is really good. But absolutely, all roads lead to control. I don't think I was in EOC when the Manchester bombing actually, when it happened. And I remember there's that weird sort of eerie feeling, like something. And even though it wasn't in London, you know, I think it sort of brings about a certain sort of quiet hush where, you know, you can go, because the other thing as well is they always come out of nowhere, right? It's a really, really average, normal weekday or whatever when there's not much going on. Then all of a sudden, like, something will happen. And there's that, I think in London, there's that definite shift in gear, and you can really feel it when, you know, something happens and, everyone becomes very quietly focused, and there's a lot of, you know, very specific chat. And these are other reasons, I guess, why they open up the separate control room, so people that are concentrating on business as usual in London aren't being distracted by the incident. And but yeah, that's from an EOC point of view. I think that has changed a lot over the years. I don't know, Kit, Owen, does that you've obviously spent you were in London before both me and Keir started. Is that something that, has that always been the case, or does that feel like it's something that's changed?
Yeah, I think over time, as you said, like, it's been iterative and lessons learned from different incidents. And to yours and Keir's point, you know, it does start with a good sense of information gathering and a semblance of how is this escalating quickly? What's the aggregation of calls? What's the demographic of course in one area? And indeed, you're right, a sense of, you know, a picture speaks a thousand words, right? So if you can get some CCTV evidence, or if you can get a good SAM link, which we never did have, but it's about piecing information together quickly, trying to talk yourself into it rather than talk yourself out of an early dispatch, but with, as to Keir's point, having safety as a hierarchy priority. So having sometimes a lower threshold rather than a higher threshold, because I think we've all sometimes talked ourselves out of dispatching on incidents whereby you look back and you think there was some really key piece of information there, and actually I probably should have seen through my back, dropped my biases and sent early. But yeah, it's been iterative to your question, Alec, and I think the good thing is about London is, as you say, they've learned lessons, they've been put in those difficult situations time and time again, and then we've, the aggregation of learning is hopefully as compounded over time. But Keir, could you speak to it?
Yeah, I think I've had experiences of Croydon and Fishmongers Hall on the desk, as well as for probably another other kind of significant incidents, where, you know, kind of multi-patient incidents. And I think it's a really, really privileged position to be in, and especially in the control room, because being able to listen into calls, you can start to really gain situational awareness very quickly. And I was, for Croydon, I was on the desk, I was on the APP desk, and a friend of ours, James, was on the HEMS desk at the time, when he was back on secondment there. And both of us were listening into calls coming in about Croydon. And I phoned a call back and spoke to her, and she was in one of the carriages. And I asked her at the time, we didn't have good sound then, to describe what she was seeing. And from that information, we both knew it was going to be a major incident, and we both knew we could start ramping up what we needed to do before certainly the first resources arrived and declared it. But already in place, we were gaining information and situational awareness. And I think Good Sam now is a game changer. I think I've used it on several occasions at multi-patient RTCs, and certainly at a gas explosion in a building a couple of months ago, where if you get a really good caller and it's safe to do so, they can walk the scene for you and you can actively see what's happening. So before anybody's even got there, you fully know in the control room, you have a good idea about what's happening. And the control room's fundamental in improving situational awareness. And some of that came out in the London Bridge recommendations and inquest around how information around patients is gained and kind of interpreted. And we have to also really, I think, pay respect to our colleagues on the desks, take the call takers. They do some phenomenal work, and certainly know that some of it must be pretty harrowing to have to do, certainly through Grenfell. And they're the beginning point of reducing the kind of care gap, because they locate patients, they know where they are. And also they can start giving airway kind of advice, and also managing hemorrhage, and also providing reassurance to patients and bystanders. So we can talk about clinicians, but also we have to think about the first point of contact to our colleagues in call taking, who do a pretty amazing job in this situation, especially the fact that they are not on scene, and that must be very difficult. But yeah, I think the control room is a fundamental start to how an incident is kind of progresses. And I think from what you've both said, London's had a lot of experience around that.
To your point, actually, Keir, I think, like you said, I think the forgotten element and one of the most important elements is the call taking, because it's the collection and sequential aggregation of data of valuable information to enable clinicians to respond, but also that vicarious trauma whereby they're at the most emotive part of a call, and it's the flow of emotion which they have to consume and indeed try and lay out in a sequential fashion, so there is some semblance of information which we can respond by. But that piece is really essential, and actually looking after call takers after retrospectively after an incident like this is absolutely key, because that element of moral injury is probably very extremely prevalent. But just pivoting and looking at the adage of triage, so I think to your point, to both your point, is fundamental from a point of call and that flow of information back and forward to the control room, because it's a table tennis, the updated methane, the ethane sequential. So there has to be this reciprocity of flow of information to enable further resources to be dispatched to scene. But just so we've now got to scene, and there's been an early dispatch. There has been good information gathering. There's been that chat, which Alec mentioned, between maybe a specialist responder, such as an advanced paramedic, and indeed maybe a flight paramedic on the desk. You've just been dispatched early on. Let's now look at the adage of triage, because triage has changed over the past few years. There's really been a few tools now which have really adapted to maybe the needs and the compounded lessons learned. Maybe, Keir, if you could speak to initially how triage has changed over the past couple of years.
It's probably worth looking historically, I suppose, at triage and at kind of learning. As I think we've often spoken about learning all the way through this, is about actually how has triage been used on multiple incidents in the past. And probably what some case studies show is that actually it's never been truly done necessarily how it should be. And I think instances shown kind of a wide variation in how triage has been undertaken. And that's been from kind of modifying triage kind of processes or no triage at all. And for example, at the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing, under 1% of patients were actually formally triaged. And the kind of subsequent report revealed that because the scene was considered too unsafe and that few paramedics arrived with triage tags, no formal triage was undertaken. Instead, they really just identified the most sickest patients through clinical kind of assessment and moved them very quickly. And multiple kind of mass shootings in America have shown similar uses of triage, where it's been either not used or sporadically, such as Fort Hood, the Pulse nightclub shooting in 2016, and the San Bernardino shooting. It was stopped kind of midway through or at the beginning because they felt that essentially that triage was interfering with patient care. And there can be a whole discussion then around that and about why is it that people aren't using necessarily triage to how it should be. And that's probably because people don't often use it. They're not practicing using it necessarily every day. If you're not within, say, a heart team or a team that is kind of trained to go to a major incident. So the stress level and the burden and the complexity of the scene, that people fall back to what they feel comfortable with. And that's probably around assessing patients and using kind of anatomical and physiological parameters instead of a kind of flow diagram. I think kind of the big thing for me around triage is my experience is really at London Bridge, and I lost my triage cards very quickly at London Bridge. And I suppose that I said earlier about the cohort of patients that we see, certainly I've dealt with in London, are patients that we see on quite a regular basis, but on a larger scale and in a more complex and challenging environment. And at London Bridge, we saw patients that had both blunt and penetrating trauma. It could have involved burns because we know they had petrol bombs in the van, but thankfully were never used. And I think what I really learned about that was that actually the triage system that we were using necessarily at the time didn't quite fit with the patient cohort that we were seeing. And quite early on, knowing the disease process of patients with penetrating trauma and how quickly we can get to them and see them in London, that they may not have got to the point where they've started to kind of declare how sick they are or had that period where they've started to decompensate. And so for me, I think kind of it's about there is that clinical decision making and that understanding about the disease process with these patients. And the risk is that certainly with penetrating torso trauma and patients with non-compressible hemorrhage, that if we don't necessarily get the triage right and they have delayed to be moved to hospital, and they then deteriorate, then perhaps we're behind the curve on their resuscitation. And for me, the big thing also is around that not all P1 patients are the same, and that some P1 patients are far sicker than others. And that's really the P1 plus, I think, which I kind of really thought about post London Bridge and about some of the patients that I saw. And there's one particular patient in particular that I met kind of 15 minutes post being injured, and were kind of displaying all the kind of signs of a patient that was actively exsanguinating from non-compressible hemorrhage and was in the dying process. And that patient was moved very quickly to hospital, didn't go through a casualty clearing station, didn't have triage repeated on them. And thankfully, as we know, all patients that got to hospital survived. And that patient was very different to a P1 patient I then saw probably 50 minutes later, having post been attacked. The first patient was within 50 minutes. The second patient, who also had significant penetrating trauma, was awake, was talking, had a heart rate of 140 with a significant chest wound, and was unwell, but was not in that phase that they were, if we didn't move them very quickly, they'd still need to go to hospital quickly because they were sick. But they weren't in that point of actively dying and exsanguinating. They needed care quickly. And I think the really important thing for me is around identifying that patient group very early. And I think that's, for me, one of the biggest lessons I've taken from major incidents and significant incidents, is around how we reduce preventable death. And that is through very early on identifying the P1 plus. I think we'll talk more around that later, around triage, and how maybe you identify that patient group. But for me, I feel that's a really important component.
Can I just jump in there quickly? Because I think that statistic around all of the patients that were transported from London Bridge is amazing, and it's not a small number. It was, do you know, Keir, can you remember how many people that were transported with injuries who survived? So like 50 or 60?
48. People. 48. Like, so eight died, 48 injured, and then three kind of terrorists that were shot dead by the police.
It's amazing. And just listening to you there in what you're talking about, you know, that's, I think maybe London Bridge was one of the first major incidents where there was this. And, you know, and from I debriefed some of the ambulance crews that were who had went to London Bridge. So I heard firsthand some of their experiences. And obviously, you know, having heard you talk about it before and listening to you just then, seems like it was the first incident where there was a step change. There was perhaps a lateral move, a pragmatic move away from traditional sort and sieve triage. And I wonder if that's because of just how dynamic the scene was. Like, you know, knowing anyone who knows Borough Market and knows that area, with the added complexity of the secondary device in the van and everything else. But you know, I think it's easy to look at these incidents and talk about the people who sadly lost their lives, and easy to forget actually all of the people who, you know, you're talking about preventable death earlier, and you know, who have survived, and you know, and maybe this is a testament as well to advanced practice, certainly in pre-hospital care, and having this mindset of, obviously, you know, your day job, working as an APP, and being able, not only having the confidence, but the knowledge and the understanding to make these decisions. Because I can think of crews who, when we were debriefing, said that they turned up at London Bridge and there were people who had been stabbed in the chest but were up and walking and were walking away from scene. And as they arrived, coming into the scene, were met with these people saying, oh, you need to help my friend. And on any other day, that's less than 5 minutes on scene, throw them in the back of the ambulance and go. But they're arriving to this, having been told it's a major incident, expecting to do triage, and technically this person's a P3. But as we all know, within minutes, they could be on the floor, you know, in a collapsed state, agonal breathing, and you know, and if it is a well, for whatever, if it's, you know, tamponade or the hypovolemic or the tensioning, these are all, you know, reverse in this instance, at least anyway, with this sort of this single modality of injury, you know, we all know these people can survive. And again, fishmongers, you know, that again, that there's, you know, some, so, you know, so tragic, the two people who did lose their lives, but then there were also patients who were, I think one in particular, I can remember one of the APPs talking about, who was really, really sick, and they treated as they would any other normal job. They, you know, very, very rapid, aggressive interventions and exceptionally quick transport with lots of things being done en route. And they survived. And again, like I guess talking a little bit about Brixton, you know, and even Manchester, it's almost, I feel like the responders who turned up at Manchester, they almost did things, it was almost too by the book. Turned up first, walked in with triage cards, you know, there were people there, there was lots of co-locating, people making, you know, people trying to ascertain whether or not it's safe, and entering that decision inertia, whereas actually what we are talking about here, and reflecting on other sort of experiences in London, actually, you know, these are, I think these are really good examples of quick, critical decision making, which is what we do every day. And yeah, and also I think as well, really speaks testament to why, you know, there's a transition and a progression with coming very imminently with triage. And I know we're going to talk about that as well.
I think there's so much to go at here. I think what we'll do is break this down into two parts, because we've still got the piece around how the new triage tool interacts again with the, maybe the major incident triage tool and the 10-second triage tool, and also looking at how we manage interdisciplinary teams and the team of teams. So I think we'll break this into two parts. But if just as we're coming to land on this part, if we could just get you to both speak to some seminal key points that from this conversation that you'd like to remind listeners of. Alec, if I could get you to speak first.
Yeah, sure. So I think for me, what we spoke about already, I think really, really key not to be concerned about ramping up early. I think the sharing of information is key. And by that, I don't just mean commanders, responders on the scene. I mean, you know, the call takers extrapolating all the right information. I think arriving on scene, doing early windscreen reports to relay that information back, and then sharing information on scene as well, so that people can make dynamic decision makings. I think being mindful of decision inertia and aiming to make decisions dynamically and rapidly, being aware of the major incident structure, but also the requirement to be pragmatic. But yeah, looking forward to chatting about the rest.
And to yourself, Kia.
So I think kind of what I've really taken from this conversation is about the importance of from very first off in the control room to those first arriving, and all the way through, is about how we gauge situational awareness and get information at each different point to help us critically think about how we're going to manage the incident and those patients. The other is really around reducing early preventable death and identifying those that are actively dying on scene, or the P1 plus patients, because not all P1 patients are the same. Some are far sicker than others. And finally then is around patient flow. And that when we identify those really sick patients, we need to be thinking about how we progress them through scene as quickly as possible, and about moving them as quickly as not even necessarily going through a casualty clearing station. Because my belief is really that the casualty clearing station isn't somewhere necessarily we're going to be able to stabilize the most sickest patients. And these patients really should be being moved off scene as quickly as possible to definitive care. Certainly in somewhere like London, where we have four major trauma centres. And I think there's probably a whole discussion about how you do that in the counties or places that can't do that necessarily and get patients to those places as quickly as possible. But yeah, I look forward to the next discussion. And yeah, hearing your thoughts. Thanks, Owen. Thanks, Alec.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.